Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Pfizer, the NRA, AT&T, and the American Insurance Association are among 21 companies and organizations with lobbying arms in every single state. Between 2010 and 2014, the number of entities lobbying at the state level increased more than 10% across the country. The Center for Public Integrity's analysis found that state-level lobbying is on the rise. So what are we seeing? Well, AT&T lobbies legislators against laws requiring it to provide landlines. Uber lobbies in 35 states, pushing to change regulations created for traditional taxis. A number of the largest pharmaceutical companies are lobbying to prevent pharmacists from substituting costly brand name drugs for cheaper versions. And of course, the list goes on. In Sacramento, there are 30 lobbyists for every politician. California has the highest ratio of lobbyists to lawmakers. In fact, at a solar lobby day in Sacramento last August, Assemblymember Evan Lowe told the group that 90% of his day is dedicated to meeting with lobbyist groups. So who has the most influence? How are lobbyists shaping state politics? What happens to the voices of average citizens, and what needs to change? Joining me to talk about the increasing role of special interest groups in California are two guests. Ben Weider is a data reporter at the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, where he focuses on state and federal politics. And Ben joins us from NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
It's great to have you. Laura Rosenhall is a reporter at Cal Matters, where she covers California politics with a focus on power in the state house. Laura's weekly news analysis explains political dynamics in the Capitol and examines how money shapes decisions that affect Californians. And Laurel joins us on the line from Sacramento. Hi, Laurel. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So, Ben, I want to start off with you. The Center for Public Integrity analyzed lobbyist registrations from 2010 to 2014, and your team found that lobbying entities at the state level have increased about 10% during those years. What explains that?
I think what we're seeing is increasingly big national corporations, organizations are seeing that there's that it makes a lot of sense for them to be to have a lobbying presence in the states. As we all know, there's less happening in Congress these days, and so we're seeing a lot of companies that that might be shifting their attention to the states, where there is a lot of things happening. You know, there's far more bills passed at the state level. Even when you account for the fact that there's 50 states, states are far more active than Congress, and so increasingly you're seeing corporations and organizations turning their eyes toward the states and saying, you know, if we can't get anything done in Washington, why not set up shop in Sacramento?
And Laurel, how would you describe this trend?
You know, I think that it absolutely makes sense. California is one of the world's biggest economies. We're home to many important industries, technology, Hollywood, wine, agriculture, oil production. Anyone who, you know, makes money in California wants to make sure that the government is making it easier for them to make money, not harder.
And how do you come up with a list that looks at the top lobby groups? Because I've seen so many different lists. So, for example, if you look at MapLight, which focuses on money and politics, they say for the last couple of years, the top interest groups include construction unions, attorneys and law firms, Indian tribes, state and local government employee unions, police and firefighter unions, and then other lists put the oil and gas industry at the top, followed by the Hospital Association, the State Council of Service Employees, the California Chamber of Commerce. So, Ben, why are these lists so different?
Well, I think it depends on what you're looking at. To come up with our list, we were looking at purely just registrations. And so what that means is how many lobbyists have you hired? Not necessarily how much are you paying them, how much are they spending on your behalf, but just how many do you have? And that's an imperfect measure. You know, when we looked at all 50 states, and in California, for example, the organization that had the most lobbyists in the time period we were looking at was AT&T, which is also on the national list as one of the top lobbying companies across the country. And I don't know definitively that AT&T spent more than spent the most of any organization in California. But I do know that, for example, in 2014, they spent nearly $4 million on lobbying. So regardless of how you slice it, they're certainly having a very big influence in California and elsewhere. And I think it's great that more people are looking at this. For us, you know, our count was really based on, you know, sort of a headcount in a way. Hmm. But I think that, ideally you'd have a mixture of a headcount and the actual money as well. California, you know, compared to many other states, actually makes it a little bit easier to track the amount of money that's being spent on lobbying. In many states, it's nearly impossible to know how much companies are actually spending. Pretty much the only thing you can get is the list of who their lobbyists are, not how much they're paying them, not how much those lobbyists are in turn spending to try to influence lawmakers.
And why is it easier in California?
I think, you know, I think every state has its own, you know, has its own sort of set of rules.
Right.
California, compared to many, is pretty open. You know, I spend a lot of time looking at data in all the states, both for campaign finance, for lobbying, for personal financial disclosures. And I can say that, you know, California definitely is among the better states in terms of what they make available and how they make it available. I mean, it's still not perfect. It's very hard to get all the data from California and kind of get it in an easy to use way. But compared to other states, which, you know, are basically, you know, a black hole, at least with California, you know something.
And Laurel, thanks to Citizens United, it is now easier than ever for corporations and wealthy individuals to influence elections. I mean, we're going to see so many propositions in November on the state and the city and state ballots. I mean, people are always overwhelmed in California because we have so many, and so much money is always poured into these campaigns. What would you say? I mean, how did Citizens United change what happens at the state level when it comes to lobbying?
Citizens United really hasn't had much impact in California because we already permitted the kind of campaign spending that Citizens United permitted at the federal level. So we already had what we call in California independent expenditures, which means an outside group, a union or a corporation, can spend unlimited money to support or oppose a candidate in an election without giving the money directly to the candidate. So Citizens United is a lot less influential in California than it is at the national level.
And so give us a sense of what actually happens at the Capitol. I was reading about this solar lobby day in Sacramento that took place last August, and a number of people who are trying to get more solar legislation passed in Sacramento spent the day talking to lawmakers. I mean, so many groups do this across the board. But what struck me is Assemblymember Evan Lowe was asked by some of these members what a typical day is like, and he told the group that 90% of his day is dedicated to meeting with lobbyist groups. How common is that?
Well, you have to realize that every single group you could imagine, and many that you've never even imagined, have a lobbyist, and they all have a presence in Sacramento, whether they're here every day of the year or they make, you know, trips here by plane or bus. Every group has a lobbyist, whether you're talking about a corporation, a labor union, an environmental advocacy group, advocates for the poor. I mean, the Catholic Church has lobbyists who were very active on legislation last year. So everyone has a lobbyist, and lobbyists will say this is how the system is meant to work. It's the constitutional right to petition government that you know, they keep track of what's going on and look out for, you know, for the interests that are paying them. So everyone has a lobbyist, and yes, legislators spend a huge amount of their time meeting with them. And every group, I mean, when you're in Sacramento, it's, you know, there's many months of the year where every single day is some group's lobby day in Sacramento. And so there are constantly rallies and meetings, and that's how it's done.
So, but who has the most influence? Because when you're talking about Solar Lobby Day, or I know that NARAL does a lobby day, they bus people in from across the state, and it's basically mm-hmm. one day where they have to raise a lot of money to buy for the lunches, for example, the transportation. But then you have the lobbyists, and their job is to be a lobbyist, and they are there every day, and they're very paid. They're paid very well for doing that job. So who has the most influence, would you say? Do you have a list of, like, the top five that we could look at?
It's not that easy to say, you know, who has the most influence in terms of who wins every single fight. The oil industry spent the most money last year. There was, a huge amount of attention on this climate change legislation that the oil industry was fighting. We have a Democratic leadership in our state that's very aggressive about trying to, you know, lead the nation on climate change policy. And there was a bill last year, Senate Bill 350, that sought to go after climate change in three different areas. And one of them would have involved cutting the use of petroleum in half. So environmental policy is a huge area that attracts a lot of lobbying on both sides. The oil industry spends more money than the environmental groups do.
And let's just talk about that for a minute, because the oil lobby spent a record $22 million in 2015, and it was kind of amazing to hear Governor Jerry Brown admit that the oil industry has so much influence, and that's why he said that they scared voters with charges that SB 350 could bring gas rationing and cost them their SUVs. And he basically said, yeah, they've got influence here, and they changed this bill.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this bill originally went after three areas, with petroleum use being one of the three, and the oil industry successfully lobbied to strip out that piece. And in the end, the bill only addressed still two big areas, but it did take out the oil piece. In the end, it went after the energy efficiency of buildings and the use of renewable electricity, you know, such as wind and solar. The oil industry is very influential. They have money to put ads on television. They do a lot of campaign donations, so they do have a lot of clout when they go in and meet with legislators. And legislators were very influenced by this idea that, you know, the bill would make it more expensive for ordinary Californians to fill up their tanks. And, you know, that is the gas prices are a very politically sensitive subject.
Right. And Ben, according to IndyBay, the record $22 million spent by the Western States Petroleum Association, the oil lobby, amounts to about $60,000 a day on oil lobbyists.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, I think that there's certainly any number of organizations and companies that are just spending, you know, millions on a regular basis. This is just sort of the cost of doing business, I think. I think what's important to remember is that, you know, this is really sort of a multifaceted approach, which I think Laurel kind of touched on. It's a combination of lobbying. It's a combination of campaign donations. It's a combination of donations to, you know, national political groups. Obviously, in California, it's a combination of donations to ballot measures where, you know, corporations spend, you know, untold millions on huge sums on these ballot measures. So it really is a multi-pronged approach. And so it's not just lobbying. I think that, you know, if you're an organization, you're thinking of all of these things and how they fit together. And we sometimes think of them as being sort of separate buckets, because, well, our lobbying data is over here in one corner and our campaign finance data is here in the other corner. Mm-hmm. But really, they're all part of the same strategy. The same strategy is influence. And there's any number of different ways you can achieve it. But you can be sure that if you're trying to accomplish things in the state capitol, you're going to use any tool that's at your disposal.
Today we are talking about the influence of lobbying at the state level. That is Ben Wider. He's a data reporter at the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C. Laura Rosenhall is a reporter at Cal Matters, where she covers California politics with a focus on power in the state houses. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What do you want to know about the influence of special interests in state legislatures? If you work for state or local government, what has your experience been like in trying to capture the attention of legislators? Are you noticing any new trends? How do you engage with lawmakers? If you've ever been involved in a lobby day, what was that experience like? The toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go to Assemblymember Mike Gatto, who represents Los Angeles. Hi, Assemblymember Gatto. Welcome to the show.
No, it's great to be here.
It's great to have you. So thank you for calling in. So do you agree with Assemblymember Evan Lowe? Is 90% of your day dedicated to meeting with lobbyist groups?
Well, I wouldn't say it's that many, but that percentage, but I do tell people the honest truth, which is if I were to accept every meeting with every lobbyist who wanted it, I could be at the Capitol from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., and every 15 minutes there would be another lobbyist waiting to meet me, and there would be a line, and you know, it really is that bad. So a lot of people talk about how legislators have short attention spans. And I sometimes wonder if it's because every 15 minutes there's somebody asking to talk about another topic.
And are we talking about major corporations? Are we talking about nonprofits? Where do you get who's asking you to meet with them the most?
Oh, it's everybody. And I should say, you know, some anecdotes that might add some color to it is how savvy and clever the lobbying groups are. You know, I have a personal rule that I prioritize people from my district. It might come as a shock to some, but there are a lot of people, you know, we each represent 500,000 people, and there's a lot of people who come up from our districts, and they want to meet with you. And obviously, when I'm back home in my district, there's a lot of people who want to meet with me who I represent. And so what the lobbying groups do, they're extremely clever, is what they'll do is, you know, let's say there's somebody who represents a snow globe manufacturer. They will find somebody who works in the snow globe industry who lives in your district, and they will have that person ask for the meeting, and then you'll take the meeting thinking that it's a regular human being, but it was arranged by some lobbyist, and some lobbyists will show up as well.
What is happening right now in Silicon Valley? There was an article in the LA Times about Uber and Lyft making their lobbying debut in 2014. Google is a relative newcomer in Sacramento, spent about $2 million since 2004 in lobbying. AT&T is a major force, spending $45 million over that same time period. How are you dealing with a lot of the Silicon Valley companies that are now getting involved with lobbying? What can you tell us about the influence that they now have in Sacramento?
There's a lot of fascinating perspectives on Silicon Valley, and they're really all over the map. One perspective, which I think is somewhat accurate, is that a lot of these companies started out as super idealistic, you know, sort of the stereotypical geeky engineer types who were developing a product with no help from government. This was not like, you know, an aerospace product that was developed on the space shuttle. I mean, this was something developed in a garage in Silicon Valley. And they thought, government will leave me alone. I don't need government, you know, and I don't plan to have any interactions with them. And they found out very fast that the incumbent industries that had something to lose were going to come after them. You know, it might be the hotel industry coming after Airbnb. It might be the taxi cabs coming after Uber and Lyft and so on and so forth. Ultimately, it's all business competition. This type of thing has probably been going on for a long time. I'm sure my predecessors, there were fights between the railroads transporting grain to the ports. There's probably a big fight with the carriage manufacturers or something like that. And, you know, and so there's been this awakening with Silicon Valley types, like, wow, you know, government actually does play a role in these things, and so we need to have a presence too.
And what about just the influence that these corporations have? I mean, I think the oil bill is a really good example. the oil bill would have cut gasoline use by 50% by 2030. And Governor Jerry Brown basically said, yeah, it's too bad the oil industry has a lot of influence and really affected this legislation. I mean, at least he was honest for once. You don't really hear politicians say that very often. But it really angers so many people across the country because they feel like their voice just doesn't matter.
Right. And I think your guest, and I hope I'm pronouncing his last name right, Mr. Reeder, you know, what he said I think was a really, really good point on this. You know, no lobbyists don't have power in and of themselves. And, you know, even if somebody pays for the most eloquent, charming person, you know, it's very important to know that these groups draw their power from this multifaceted approach. It's not just hiring the best advocates. You know, it's spending tons of money on campaign contributions and then tons of money on PR campaigns as well. So I don't personally take money from oil companies, but you know, oil companies spend an awful lot of money lobbying. And but they spend an awful lot more giving campaign contributions. And I think that's the source of their power, not just their lobbying efforts.
Well, Assemblymember Gatto, thank you for calling in.
It was great to discuss these things. And, you know, what I will say is, you know, a lot of people are down on this, but there are plenty of members who do. We absolutely prioritize the people who we represent. And, you know, I for one, I answer every email that people send me. And I do like hearing, I love hearing from constituents as opposed to lobbyists. So people should continue to contact their elected officials.
Thank you very much. Assemblymember Mike Gatto is a Democrat representing District 43 in Los Angeles, and he is the chair of a brand new Assembly Committee on Privacy and Consumer Protection. And today we are talking about lobbying at the state level. Lobbying is on the rise. We're joined by Laurel Rosenhall, a reporter at Cal Matters, where she covers California politics. Ben Weider. Ben, your last name, is it Weider or Weider?
It's Weider, but either works.
No, I want to get it right. Thank you. Ben Weider is a data reporter at the Center for Public Integrity in Washington. And Ben, I mean, this has real life consequences because you co-wrote a piece profiling Debbie Mann, who uses a drug to help her cope with arthritis. And the brand name drug currently costs her $3,800 a year. And you write that less costly drugs that function in much the same way are expected to hit American markets in the next couple of years. Yet, if the drug becomes available in the U.S., as it already is in Europe, she will face hurdles to obtain it in Indiana. And that is thanks to the quick work done by the pharmaceutical companies that swooped in to lobby the legislature there. Drug lobbyists have helped push through bills limiting pharmacists' ability to dole out these drugs in more than a third of the states since 2013. And we can guess that this is happening across the country because we often hear about high drug costs. Can you tell us more about the power of the pharmaceutical industry at the state levels?
Yeah, the pharmaceutical company wields a major influence. I mean, when we were looking at our at companies that were active across the country, pharmaceutical companies took up the biggest share of our list of top 100 companies of any other industry, accounting for nearly one in five of the top 101 entities that were active all across the country. I mean, I think that the biosimilars laws is what this is. Biosimilars, it's basically a generic, but it's a little bit more complicated than a standard sort of generic drug. And that's part of the reason why pharmaceutical companies in this case are getting involved in it, because it's a very new drug, very new concept. And so states are trying to figure out, you know, this is something that's new. We haven't had this before. How do we handle this? And it affects a lot of people. I mean, you know, if you have rheumatoid arthritis, you might be taking one of these drugs, and it could have a huge impact on your life. And in the case of Debbie Mann, what was kind of interesting was while this legislative discussion was happening in Indianapolis, she didn't even know it was happening, and she and many other patients weren't even aware that lawmakers, lobbyists, interest groups were having these discussions in the state capitol that were going to have a major impact on their quality of life and you know, on their pocketbook. And I think that's the case in a lot of places. We know that that at least, I think, 18 states have passed laws related to these types of drugs, including California. And in many cases, what you see is that the influences on one side the pharmaceutical industry, and on the other side, the insurance industry. And the reason why they're sort of fighting about this is for the insurance industry, they're saying, we want to keep our costs down. If there's a cheaper alternative, we'd rather have the cheaper alternative. Mm-hmm. The pharmaceutical companies are saying, you know, we've developed these drugs. We've spent, you know, millions and millions of dollars developing these drugs, maybe billions of dollars in some cases. We want to be able to make sure that we get paid for our big, expensive brand name drugs as long as possible to recoup that investment and, you know, obviously turn a profit as well. So, you know, this kind of conflict is playing out in probably every state house in the country. I mean, this is kind of a classic fight that happens at the state level because states are often the ones who are making these decisions about which drugs are covered, how they're covered, how they're reimbursed, which drugs patients can get through their insurance, which drugs they can't. These are debates that are happening at the state level. And so it's very common to be seeing a pharmaceutical industry lobbyist on one side, an insurance industry lobbyist on the other side, and the legislators in the middle trying to figure it out.
According to Open Secrets, the pharmaceutical industry spent $240 million on lobbying last year.
Yeah, they're huge. I mean, they're definitely a huge spender on both the federal level and the state level, and there's good reason. I mean, their products are tremendously affected by regulations and by laws, and so obviously, you know, it's going to have a major impact on their bottom line, what those laws are, what those regulations are.
Ben Weider is a data reporter at the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C., where he focuses on state and federal politics. Laurel Rosenhall is a reporter at Cal Matters, where she covers California politics with a focus on power in the state house. Today, we're talking about the influence of lobbyists in Sacramento and at the state level. It's on the rise. What questions do you have about how this process works? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, a program that's always more interesting when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Or you can send your email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org or simply leave a comment on the website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, the BBC's World Have Your Say, and at noon today from our friends at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, it's Bina.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing coverage of President Obama's historic visit to Cuba. How will Cuba-U.S. relations change mainstream reporting on Cuba? We will also talk about coverage of the AIPAC conference, the pro-Israel lobbying group, where nearly every presidential candidate pledged their unwavering support for Israel. Senator Bernie Sanders was the only candidate to decline the invitation to speak at the conference. We'll discuss coverage of that. And if you have a show idea, a guest idea, or an article you want us to mention on tomorrow's show, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about the role special interest groups and lobbyists play in the California legislature. Federal lobbying is pretty much flat. In some ways it's declining, but it's flat when you look at the major corporations. But it is on the rise at the state level, according to the Center for Public Integrity. And we're talking about it with Ben Weider. He's data reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. Laura Rosenhall is a reporter at Cal Matters, where she covers California politics. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Jay in Sacramento. Hi, Jay. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for taking my call. And Ben and Laurel, my name is Jay Wieringa. I'm the communications director for the State Fair Political Practices Commission. So we are the entity that enforces the rules regarding campaign finance and lobbying reporting. And I just wanted to call in and commend you for taking up this topic, because it is obviously something that is very important. People obviously have a right to lobby their government, but our job in particular, thanks to the voters of California, which created us 42 years ago, we are all about making sure to the best way possible to give disclosure on what's being done. And I found it interesting that as Laurel was talking about SB 350, we recently wanted your listeners to know that we do take this very seriously, and we have done a number of things in recent months, and will continue this year as the chair of the FPPC, Jody Remke, is focusing on lobbying to sort of tighten up the rules on this sort of thing and provide more disclosure. And you mentioned SB 350. One of the things we noted is in recent years, more and more, there used to be a category of other payments to influence, and Ben mentioned this as well, and so did Assemblymember Gatto, that it's not just person-to-person lobbying. It's how groups try to sway legislators and public opinion in a variety of ways, and there was a measure of lobbying where lobbying groups could put things under other payments to influence, and we found on the SB 350, as a matter of fact, I think a number of reporters found this, that up to 90% of the spending on that bill was under this other payments. So it was this catch-all category that lobbyists could just put anything under. And so we passed a measure, the FPPC voted, the commissioners voted unanimously late last year to provide more disclosure on that, to break it down, not just other payments, but it goes to hiring public affairs campaigns, consultants, advertising, that sort of thing. So I wanted your listeners to know that, you know, we do take this very seriously. We are, and we're trying to find more ways to provide more disclosure.
Well, thank you for calling in. On that point, Laurel, of more disclosure, can you tell us about the Voters' Right to Know Act? Los Gatos software entrepreneur Jim Heerwagen, according to the Sacramento Bee, spent about $670,000 on this. He really wanted to put it on the ballot, but realized it was going to cost way too much money. So now it is Senate Bill 1349, introduced by Senator Bob Hertzberg, Democrat of Los Angeles, and it's a $13.5 million plan to revamp the state's 15-year-old campaign finance database into a modern tool that reports in real time how politicians are raising and spending money. What are your thoughts on this? And is this getting much support in Sacramento, the Voters' Right to Know Act?
Well, we'll see. I mean, updating the system would be very useful for those of us who, you know, use the disclosure system to sort of keep track of who's spending money and what they're spending it on. But, you know, anything that involves spending money is going to be a negotiation among the legislators. And I think it remains to be seen whether this will, you know, rise to the top of the priority list.
All right. Well, we'll put information about that on the website. So no, it's not going to be on the ballot because it's so expensive to put things on the ballot.
Right.
But it will. It is now. It was introduced. So we'll see what happens
it's
with
a
that.
Bill, exactly.
Yeah, it's a bill. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for calling in, Jay. Let's go next to Kitty in San Francisco. Hi, Kitty. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. My only comment or question is, are there a lot of good lobbyists out there advocating on behalf, whether it's on the state or national level, for people in this country? You know, when I think of the term lobbyist, it has a very negative connotation for me. So,
yeah, well, as Laurel said earlier, I mean, if you're in favor of solar, there are solar lobbyists. There are lobbyists for children. There are lobbyists for hunger. Laurel, how would you answer Kitty's question?
I think I couldn't hear a key word.
She said that the word lobbyist has a negative connotation. Mm-hmm. But what about people lobbying for causes that you believe in?
It's completely subjective, right? I mean, the lobbyists in Sacramento frequently complain that the word has a negative connotation. In fact, many of them will call themselves legislative advocates, governmental advocates, consultants. You know, a lot of them avoid the term because it does have a negative connotation, but It is a technical term. I mean, if you are officially a lobbyist, you do have to register with the state of California as a lobbyist and disclose your sources of income and the bills that you're lobbying on. So, I mean, I think that for every issue that the legislature takes up, there are various viewpoints. There are lobbyists on both sides, and then there are entities behind those lobbyists, whether they're ordinary citizens or labor unions or major corporations or other kinds of special advocacy groups like environmental groups or others that that believe in them. So it's a highly subjective thing, just like all of these issues that the legislature tackles are up for debate.
Right. So depending on what you believe in, if there's a nonprofit working on these issues, they probably do have a lobby day.
Sure, and they probably employ lobbyists, and
yeah.
So I mean, that's it is part of the process, and maybe it's, you know, not so helpful to the process that it has become such a word with such negative connotations, because maybe that makes it seem like something sinister is happening where it's not. I don't know.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Kitty. I mean, one way you can think of it is public interest lobbyists, maybe, versus corporate lobbyists. But thanks for raising that. Let's go next to Cody in San Francisco. Hi, Cody. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. I just wanted to add to the conversation, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. I think they're probably the largest force in lobbying in this country at the state level. And basically what they do is they wine and dine, have these huge parties for state legislators across the country, and they have cookie cutter bills that essentially, like the whole right to work thing, where they've eviscerated the unions in a lot of states, and they will introduce these bills that are almost the same in every single state, because it's a gridlock at the federal level, so they're changing the laws of the country state by state. Using members of ALEC to introduce these bills at the state legislature. And I think a lot of what happens secret behind closed doors, and I don't even know if they even have to really report a lot of the money that they spend on it, because it's like these bigger events that's not just going to one candidate. They're giving corporations access to hundreds and hundreds of candidates from all around the country.
Yeah, thank you. We haven't done a show about ALEC in a while, but they had their annual conference last July in San Diego. Ben, have you been tracking ALEC at the state level?
It's certainly something that we come across on a regular basis. I mean, for example, in the story, this wasn't necessarily an ALEC bill, but the bill that I was talking about before, the substitution of these biosimilar generic drugs, basically, for certain other drugs, a lot of the text from that language was coming basically from the pharmaceutical companies themselves, and very similar text was appearing in a number of states. I think this is actually fairly common, and I think that there's good and bad of it. I mean, the reality of the situation is legislators in many cases at the state level have fairly limited staffs. There's only so much expertise they can have. They're not necessarily going to be an expert on every issue that they're covering. To some extent, they need help from people from various interest groups to even get a handle on what are the key issues in a particular legislative debate. So I think that, you know, what we saw for sure was that a lot of the text of some of these bills was coming from lobbyists themselves, or from organizations like ALEC, and, you know, there's similar organizations sort of on the progressive side as well that aren't quite as well known. But certainly that's something that I think is fairly widespread. I mean, Laurel maybe can talk to it more about at the California level, but I think, you know, certainly we've heard that from legislators and from, you know, from people who are actively following these issues in states across the country.
Laurel, have you reported on ALEC at the state level?
You know, I've looked into it, and ALEC is generally more successful in Republican mm-hmm. legislatures. And, you know, in California, our legislature is dominated by Democrats, and every single state-level official in California is a Democrat. So it doesn't quite have the receptive audience here that it might in other states, but I will say that there's one issue that is on ALEC's list of sort of model bills, and it has to do with something called the low carbon fuel standard. And that is the idea of sort of reformulating gas so that it has less petroleum and more a mix of more cleaner burning fuels. It's a, the low carbon fuel standard is something that generally environmentalists support and want to put in place, and that the oil industry opposes. And so ALEC has opposition to a low carbon fuel standard as one of its model bills. And California recently passed a low carbon fuel standard. It wasn't something that went through the legislature. It went through the Air Resources Board, which is a state regulatory agency, and it was supported by Governor Jerry Brown. But the oil industry right now appears to be sort of gearing up to try to phase out this policy or overturn it in future years. They are bringing in economists from Harvard to talk to legislators and business leaders about sort of how they see that, that this is a damaging policy. There are lots of clean fuel advocates who are gearing up, saying that, you know, they need to, if you know, they need to work hard to keep the policy in place. And so that is one example of an ALEC issue that is surfacing in California, and that could be a very big, expensive, and interesting fight in the Capitol this year.
Hmm. Well, thank you for that. We will definitely follow that. And thanks for calling in, Cody. There is a website called alecexposed.org, and it looks like they do follow the legislation ALEC is working on. They're working on plastic bag bans, for example, privatization of education. There's a lot of good information here. But as Laurel said, most of the state activity is outside of California. Today, we're talking about the role that special interest groups, corporate lobbyists play in Sacramento. And today we're joined by Ben Weider, a data reporter at the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C. Laurel Rosenhall is a reporter at Cal Matters, where she covers California politics. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And according to Public Integrity's website about California's top five lobbying entities, there are consistently AT&T, Edison International, LA County, Comcast, and the City of Los Angeles. Can you tell us more about that? Laurel, have you been following this? What is the City of Los Angeles lobbying for?
Well, local governments do a lot of lobbying in Sacramento, and it is kind of a strange thing because you'd think that, you know, a mayor or a city councilman could just pick up the phone and call his state legislator. But it is a fact that local governments, counties and cities and school districts do a tremendous amount of lobbying in Sacramento. So on the one hand, it does seem like kind of a head scratcher. On the other hand, when you think about that all the money that they get flows through Sacramento, or maybe not all of it, but a huge amount of it flows through Sacramento in some way. And so they do have a huge interest in, you know, all the state budget issues, you know, welfare programs, policing, I mean, so many things that transportation issues, I mean, so many things that have to do with, you know, how local governments fund their services for the public, those decisions about how much money they get come through Sacramento. Mm-hmm.
And what are the biggest issues right now for public employee lobbies?
Wow. Well, you know, they had a huge issue in the Supreme Court until Justice Scalia died with the Friedrichs lawsuit. There seems to be hanging in the balance now. They are, the SEIU is always every year trying to do bills that would allow them to unionize child care workers. They are frequently lobbying for more money for programs that, you know, that serve the needy, because many of those programs employ their members. In-home support services is a caretaking service for disabled and invalid people, and they're always lobbying for more money for that. There's just, you know, teachers' unions are big lobbyists, so Again, anything that has to touches the state budget is going to attract a lot of lobbying.
We have a couple of questions about the law around this. Philip writes, at what point does gift giving to politicians become corruption? Can a lobbyist take a politician to a five-star restaurant legally, but not buy him or her a Rolex? Where does the line get crossed? Laurel?
Oh, there are a lot of rules. Lobbyists who are registered lobbyists can only give up to, can only take a public official to a meal that is worth up to $10. But the enormous loophole there is that the company that employs the lobbyist could, you know, take them to a meal that costs $300. So there are a lot of rules, and for every rule, there seems to be a way to work around it.
And the lobbying laws across the country vary state by state, right, Ben? I mean, according to your group, the Center for Public Integrity, some states require government employees to register if they lend expertise to lawmakers. New York requires lobbyists register only if they earn or spend $5,000 a year. In Texas, part-time lobbyists are not always required to register. So lobbying laws really vary across the country.
They vary widely, and I think, you know, Laurel makes a great point, which is that, you know, there's any number of ways to get around them. And I think what often is sometimes lost in the discussion of lobbying is it's not just a question of nice gifts and fancy meals. It's really, I mean, I think for many lobbyists, it's really about relationships. You know, I know that I've talked with lobbyists in a number of states, and it's really their relationships with lawmakers or with regulators that is the most important factor. It's not necessarily that they're taking them out to dinner or taking them out to lunch. They're just popping in, you know, their office to say hi and say, hey, did you have a chance to look at this line that we favor in this particular piece of regulation or in this particular law? It's really, I think, the best lobbyists in many cases are not the best lobbyists because they're throwing out the most money. In many cases, I think it's because they have the best relationships and the best network in the state. I mean, we know just from looking at the top lobbyists in a number of states that in many cases you're talking about former officials, you're talking about former chiefs of staff. And so really the relationship is their currency more so than even any sort of meal or gift that they're giving to lawmakers.
Yeah, I would completely agree that, you know, the lobbyists in this town will be very quick to tell you it's a relationship business. I mean, politics generally is a relationship business. And because we have term limits in the California legislature, we have a lot of lobbyists who have more experience, knowledge, and expertise than the elected legislators. So they, they were around working on whatever their issue is before that person was elected, and they'll still be working on it after that person has left office. So a lot of the power comes from developing those relationships and being seen by the elected officials as a source of expertise, you know, someone who can really educate the legislator on the issue.
And then, Ben, you have to look at who has the resources to actually build those relationships.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I think, you know, it's interesting because I think that you know, many times we look at the expenditures, at how much they're spending on a meal, on a gift, as though that's the real indication of lobbying. In fact, it's the salaries in many cases that lobbyists themselves are drawing. And they're drawing those salaries because of their resume, basically. They're drawing those salaries because they have that expertise that Laurel was talking about, because they have those relationships. That's really where the big money is going. It's not necessarily a particular meal or, you know, tickets to a game. I mean, those things do add up. But in many cases, the biggest spending by companies on lobbying is just the salary of the lobbyists and themselves. And, you know, if someone's going to be giving advice to a lawmaker about, you know, a particular issue that, you know, that the lawmaker is considering, if you're a company, you'd like to have that person that's going to give the best advice working on your behalf. I mean, that's just going to help you out.
Right. Well, can you talk a little bit about where we've seen changes? Nicholas writes in and says, how is this information provided to the public through the online Cal Access portal? How timely, useful, and accessible is this information? And are there other states we should be looking to? Laurel, do you know?
Well, I'll talk about CalAccess, and maybe Ben can talk about other states. The information on CalAccess is filed quarterly by the lobbyists, and it is fairly detailed. They do report, you know, every meal and, you know, ticket to a 49ers game or whatnot that they give to the legislator. They report what bills they work on. They report which lobbyists they're paying to do their work. There was this problem with this mysterious category that Jay from the FPPC alluded to earlier, where there was a huge amount of money being spent in a category called Other that had no line item reporting. But the FPPC recently passed a new rule that hopefully by the middle of this year will kick in and require that they any you know, companies that employ a lobbyist have to kind of line item what they're spending in that other category. A lot of it probably went toward TV advertising, but it was impossible to know. So we should be getting more information in the second half of this year than we've ever had before about the lobby spending. And the information is, you know, housed at this portal at CalAccess, which is part of the Secretary of State's website. And then the reports are made every 3 months, 1 month after the quarter ends. So it would be great if we could get the information in more real time, because when votes are being cast in the legislature, you don't have an up-to-the-minute look at who's lobbying on that issue. All of the information is always a few months outdated. But that is, you know, how the system is laid out here in California.
And Ben, we have just about a minute left. Have you seen any major changes across the state that would make this process more transparent?
I haven't necessarily seen major changes in the time we've been tracking this. I mean, I know that that there are a number of states that have made changes in recent years. I think New York has made some changes to how they display lobbying information in the past. And certainly the more real time, typically the better. But I have to say, from having looked at a number of states, California is better than many. I don't necessarily know that it's the best in the country, but I would say it's certainly among the half dozen best states in terms of disclosure, just in terms of the ease of information and the sort of thoroughness of the information, even with those loopholes. One of the other things that I think is good that California does, and that a few other states do as well, is it is a little easier to figure out which particular bills organizations are lobbying on, and then even on particular bills, you know, who the opponents are and the supporters are of particular bills. I think California does a better job of that than a lot of other states, where it's really difficult to find that information.
Ben Weider is a data reporter at the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C. Laurel Rosenhall is a reporter at Cal Matters, where she covers California politics. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of President Obama's historic visit to Cuba. How will U.S.-Cuba relations change mainstream reporting on Cuba? We'll also talk about coverage of the AIPAC conference, the pro-Israel lobbying group, where nearly every presidential candidate pledged their unwavering support for Israel. Senator Bernie Sanders was the only candidate to decline the invitation to speak in person. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.